the 90.7 FM
Ica.
Copic.
Cairo.
Catskill. Greenport. Claverack. Kinderhook.
Maryville.
Germantown.
Wyndham. Greenville.
Schoharie. Green County.
Patrick. Ashland.
Chatham.
And East Durham.
Athens.
Haines Falls. Hunter.
And, Coxsackie.
Preston Hollow. Oak Hill.
Ankrum.
Great Barrington.
Hawthorne Valley.
New Baltimore. And
Hudson, New York.
The views expressed by on-air volunteer hosts do not reflect the views of Wavefarm or WGXE. WGXE is nonpartisan and does not endorse or support political candidates. To participate in WGXE's on-air dialogue, dial 518-622-2598 to either call in live to the studio or record a 3-minute message for broadcast expressing your point of view, or send an email to info@wgxe.org.
Hi, everyone. It's Lily, the youth peer leader from Mental Health Association of Columbia Green County's Clubhouse. Are you a teen wanting to learn more about health education? Maybe you're looking to complete your volunteer hours or in need of a job. The weekly teen clinic on Wednesdays from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Family Planning, located on the third floor of the county building on Main Street in Catskill, can help you answer any of your questions. Information can be found at greengovernment.com. Hope to see you there.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Becca Van Kay of Pearling, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Hey, this is Rob Lumberg, host of Uncontaminated Sound. Today I have a special guest and honored to have him on, Professor Anand Pandian, author of Something Between Us, The Everyday Walls of American Life and How to Take Them Down. Anand, please welcome to Uncontaminated Sound.
Thank you so much, Rob. It really is a pleasure to be able to join you today.
Yes, I first encountered your work in Hudson a couple months ago, and I was fascinated with your outtake or your perspective and thesis regarding everyday American life and how actually, yeah, all these minute walls one may not think about have been kind of creating these isolated bubbles that we find ourselves in. And I guess a little bit of background. So where does your journey begin, I guess? And then we'll get back into the book or into any topics that stem from that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really do appreciate it. And I want to acknowledge in particular for those who are listening, just my personal fondness for the Hudson River Valley area. There's so many interesting, creative, and thoughtful visionaries, in fact, that have that live in that area, that have come out of that area. And it really is wonderful to be in conversation with folks from the Hudson area once again. As Rob mentioned, I did have the real pleasure of speaking about this particular book earlier this summer. I believe it was in July, if I remember correctly, at the Spark in Hudson. Yeah, at an event that was hosted by the Spark, for which I am absolutely grateful. And if folks from the Spark are listening, I want to acknowledge you once again as well. Personally speaking, I am a cultural anthropologist. I teach at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm Indian American. My family came here in the 1970s. My father is a physician, and it really was the pursuit of possible work opportunities and a different kind of life for their children that led my parents to emigrate here to the United States in those years. Of course, anthropology isn't necessarily at the top of the list when it comes to what immigrant families are looking for their children to do. But my parents have been extremely generous and supportive with regard to everything that myself, my brother, and sister have all been committed to as we've grown up as Americans here in this country. And as an anthropologist, I've actually spent most of my career doing research, thinking, and writing about our more native places in India and in South India in particular. Though I grew up in the United States, though I was born and raised in this country, I really didn't feel that I had very much to say about where I've lived for most of my life. And it was really in the wake of the 2016 presidential election that I made a decision to shift the focus of my own ongoing work and to try to make sense of where we are in this country, how we got here, and what we might do about it.
Yeah, that's, I think 2016 kind of, I actually was the first month in New York City for myself after transferring or just making the move, breaking from my own bubble from Boston area to New York City. And the day after the election, there was this collective sadness throughout the city. This overarching, I guess, fear, maybe, possibly, of the unknown. We've never seen a candidate like that in office. And it was just this surreal experience of seeing this collective whole of human emotion in a whole city.
Yeah, and of course, here, as with really everything else, I think the question is, which collective are we speaking of?
Yes.
Because certainly within my own narrower social and professional circles, there was a great deal of shock, of dismay, of unease, especially those of us who come from minority backgrounds, those of us who care about the plight of migrants to this country, those of us who are Muslim or concerned about the rising tide of Islamophobia in this country, and not only the anti-immigrant rhetoric we saw a great deal of in that presidential campaign, but also specifically the anti-Muslim rhetoric. There's a lot of things,
yeah,
I think that were concerning. But at the same time, the reality is that there were many, many people that were jubilant about that outcome, that were thrilled that we had a very different kind of representation in the works for the leadership of the country. And this is something that I wanted to make sense of.
Yeah.
As an anthropologist, regardless of however strongly myself and people like me might have felt about the undesirability of that outcome, how do we make sense of this profound appeal of a very different kind of politics that in some ways cuts to the heart of some of the assumptions that many of us make about where the country is headed, where it could be headed, where it should be headed? And what would it mean to try to approach the country all over again with a broader range of perspectives and understandings in mind? That's what led me to try to write this book.
So once you had that idea post-election and concept for the research, the book, by the way, to any listeners out there, is broken into four parts in several different dispatches. How did you, like, regarding process, you had this the concept, the overarching thesis. How did you decide to start pursuing these specific stories in locations and dispatches and group that together into the entirety of the book?
So I, as an anthropologist, I have certain techniques at my disposal. There are ways that we work. There are ways that we do our research that distinguishes our field from other intellectual fields. Our work as anthropologists is generally fieldwork based, which means that when we're trying to understand any social phenomenon, when we're trying to make sense of people's lives in a particular place, we take really seriously the idea that we have to go there, we have to be there, we have to talk to people who are there, we have to get, try as much as possible to get some sense of what life is like in those places from the inside out, rather than resting on whatever assumptions or knowledge we might already have from the outside. So in committing to doing a book like this, what I had to also commit to doing was to spending time in parts of the country where I hadn't spent much time before, or if I had, I hadn't really been paying attention to in the way that we've been talking about. I had to make a commitment to get a different kind of understanding of the United States by immersing myself in the company of people whose ideas and life ways were very different from my own, and whose everyday environments were also very different from my own. My own being the city of Baltimore, where I live with my family, where I've lived now for nearly two decades. And it began really, in a sense, sort of in fits and starts. There are things that I began to do sort of closer to home. For example, just a couple weeks after the election, I went to a victory rally for Donald Trump in Hershey, Pennsylvania, just heading up the 83, the I-83 from where we live in Baltimore. It's a really interesting, at times kind of harrowing, but ultimately really, really interesting experience, that particular exposure. It's something I've written about separately as well. And as I continued to try to figure out how I was going to develop this book, I was thinking in particular about the border wall, the centrality of the promise of an impenetrable barrier between the United States and Mexico to that victorious presidential campaign. And I was trying to make sense of why it is that the idea of a wall between one country and another would be so appealing to so many people. And once again, as an anthropologist, if my job is to pay attention to the circumstances of people's lives, to make sense of the ideas that they take most seriously, it did strike me that if we're trying to make sense of something so big and abstract, and in fact it's so distant as a wall between one country and another along that particular region in the United States, the border region, that it might make sense to pay attention to the other kinds of walls and divides and barriers and boundaries that Americans live with in their daily lives, and to see whether those everyday walls might have something to teach us with regard to the appeal of something like a national wall, which is how I got to that structure of the book.
Oh, yes, yes. I guess overarching, like from your experience of writing the book, what have you found, I guess, actually, no, I'm sorry. I guess, what is your impression, I guess, of after writing and finishing and publishing the book, what is your impression regarding the overall state of the nation regarding, do you see any way where there could be harmonious unions past the fear and actually in overarching nation, or is it really, do we have to focus on the micro communities at the community level first before we can even address the larger national issues like such?
Yeah, it's a really important question. It's a really difficult question. And I think anytime we talk about union, we talk about unity, it behooves us to pay close attention to the divisions first, the disunity first. Mm-hmm. If you want to talk about something like unity, what is the problem that this talk of unity seeks to address? Yeah. If you want to talk about bringing people together, what is it that's keeping them apart? This is something I think that we may not understand with the degree of depth and clarity that we need. And so, as you know from having read the book, but for the benefit of listeners who may not have read the book, what I try to say is that in paying attention to people's everyday lives in the country, there are different kinds of everyday, ordinary barriers or walls that have become responsible for a great deal of isolation and separation and ultimately suspicion and even hostility. For me, they have to do, and this is in a sense that sort of fourfold structure of the book that you were alluding to earlier, they have to do with the walls of our homes and neighborhoods, the way in which a logic of ever deeper separation and isolation has gone into the structure of American neighborhoods, the securitization or the infiltration of security technologies into the way in which our homes are organized and managed, that boundary between the inside and the outside of homes, but also at the level of our neighborhoods, the way in which gated communities and other kinds of contemporary urban developments build on longstanding histories of residential segregation and spatial patterns of diffusion that continue dynamics of suburbanization that we've seen for many decades now. I'm also thinking about what I call life on the road or walls on the road, the way in which our habits of getting around in the world have come to rely so deeply not only on automobiles, but on automobiles that are ever larger, ever more bulky in their size and shape and composition, SUVs and trucks that have come to dominate the American automotive market like no other form of automotive transport, built really like tanks. And again, sort of feeding on this idea of a radical separation between those on the inside and those on the outside. I talk about cultures of the body and the way in which so many Americans have come to imagine their own bodies as fortresses that need to be armored off and sealed off from contact and possible contamination from others. And I talk about how all these different physical dynamics feed, ultimately intensify what I call in the book, the walls of the mind. That is to say, the way in which our social media, our information architectures and ecosystems, again, divide us into different realities, parallel realities, circumstances in which we might be side by side with someone else, each of us plugged in to a different set of headphones, and though we occupy the same physical space, we might be in a completely different space of imagination and concern. All of these dynamics, I argue in the book, feed on each other, intensify each other, and create that circumstance of radical division that we find ourselves wrestling with time and again in this country. And ultimately, I argue that unless we confront all those everyday infrastructures of separation and division at that level of our ordinary lives and our experience of the world side by side with other Americans, we will struggle to overcome that political and social impasse that we keep talking about and fretting over. We know it's an issue, but how are we going to deal with it? That question will remain insoluble unless we pay attention to some of these everyday dynamics.
Well, it's fascinating, and one could one or myself will ask then, how do you get people at the table of all these different opinions and in these silos? How do you get these everybody together at a table, or at least a handful of diverse sides at the table, and have these discussions and see if there's common ground? I'm a big proponent of like trying to get people of diverse backgrounds together, at least over generally food or beverage, and that's generally the common denominator. And then you kind of loosen up and have these discussions about what their viewpoints are. I'm curious, how do you kind of, how do you get this message across, or like have these discussions with a larger group or of these diverse populations just of diverse people and opinions, you know?
Yeah, it's a really important question. And I think that one thing you said is absolutely spot on, the value of more informal occasions and circumstances for people to be in proximity with others, to be in proximity with others they may not know that well, to be in proximity with others they may not have that much in common with, to be in proximity with others they might not really agree about that much. How can you create circumstances in which people who have their differences can nonetheless share a space and even a life together, at least for those moments, that might be productive of other kinds of relationships? Other forms of social possibility, other ways of seeing things from the standpoint of others. I tell stories in the book from lots of different places, and that specific strategy that you're speaking of is one, for example, that a Somali-American activist that I met and got to know in the town of Fargo, in the metropolitan area of Fargo-Moorhead, spoke of to me and was practicing as a way of wrestling with ongoing patterns of Islamophobia and suspicion when it came to Muslim immigrants, in particular to that area, and talking about strategies of more informal interaction that would bring Muslims and non-Muslims together, that would put them side by side, that would allow them to share a meal and conversation as one way of dealing with some of the stereotypes and assumptions that people carry. Community organizers are doing this work in places like Fargo and in many other places around the country. And that is actually, I think, quite consequential and important. It's precisely, for example, I think that vision that animates a space like the Spark in Hudson. From what I understand, the idea of creating a public circumstance where people can have more unusual conversations by giving space for those possibilities.
My ethos has always been just to go out and try to experience the world and travel through travel and having as many diverse experience as possible. The beginning year, I was volunteering on a disaster relief operation down in rural Georgia. There was Helene did tons of damage down there to rural communities, and I was also documenting and gathering audio and interviewing homeowners about their experiences. For me, being from the Northeast, it was a totally different world. And it seemed like a different country down there. Particularly, you see the landscape of just the destruction from the storm. And I didn't realize myself how isolated these communities are from a lot of modern infrastructure. And their reliance on their community or their just family to, and one woman had to live without power for a month, hot water or electricity for a month or two, and her son had to, her son's living arrangement was basically a shack. He was having to live with burning wood in that shack, and that was destroyed through the storm. He had to kind of live with her, and then they couldn't find any assistance from FEMA. They barely had internet access. Information flow was non-existent. It was word of mouth. the trust in the federal government was very limited until this NGO, this private NGO, came in, and we get, you know, we cleared the trees and the debris that was blocking the power, and the next day she had power and running water again, and heat and electricity. So that was a powerful moment for myself going into that scenario where it awakened my perspective of this nation, where being fortunate enough to be in the Northeast Corridor, in being growing up in suburbia, I didn't realize how vast America is and how rural it is.
So
that's just one experience on my end this year where I'm like, wow, America is totally different than what we see just on the media or in social media.
It's a really important point, and it's really easy, I think, for all of us to generalize really quickly from what's immediately around us to assume that the world must look and feel more or less the same as it does for us. I think it's easy to make that assumption. I don't think you can blame people for making that assumption, but the reality is that there's an enormous amount of difference in the circumstances of people's lives. I put literally thousands and thousands of miles on our car in driving around, driving across the country, driving north, driving south. I took a number of shorter trips to different parts as well. The book itself is ultimately founded on field work, anthropological field work in more than a dozen states around the country. And yeah, absolutely. I definitely got a really serious glimpse of how different things can be, depending on how you're positioned geographically in this country, but also socially and racially. The circumstances of either care on the one hand or radical and abiding neglect on the other have a great deal to do with where you're positioned. Again, both physically and geographically on the one hand, but also socially and racially. There's a lot of discourse right now about how the state is way too involved in things, the heavy hand of government, way too involved, way too intrusive. And yet, as you rightly say, as you point out, as you saw yourself in your firsthand experience of this most recent hurricane, there are plenty of places where there just isn't enough state presence. There just isn't enough of that governmental attention and concern. And people are doing what they can, scraping by with what they're able to manage on their own, or typically under such circumstances in solidarity with others who are also facing similar circumstances of sanctioned and official neglect. So on the one hand, there are these circumstances of isolation, separation, and division that we've been talking about until now. But when we get to the question then of how it is that people live with those circumstances, how they survive under those circumstances, especially those who are dealing with the forms of deep and abiding inequality that you're speaking of now, there's another side to this social life that we also need to be keeping in mind, which is the possibility of looking after each other, the possibility of trying in whatever way to make up for that lack of attention and concern. And one of the larger arguments I'm also trying to make in the book is that we have a lot to learn from those gestures of mutual aid, of collective solidarity, of collective caretaking. There are other traditions that communities have developed in this country in the face of that kind of neglect and indifference that I think have a lot to teach us about what it means to lean back in to what we owe each other, what we can rely on each other for, and ultimately a different picture of who we might be for each other as a country and as a people.
But just to be like a bit of a devil's advocate as well, though, do you think the rural population has a deep mistrust in academia, in the academic class, and,
sure.
and their viewpoints on, say, academics like yourself, and how do they
sure.
view your type of work in general, I guess, or the generalization, but.
Well, the reality is that we are living through a period of a kind of enormous backlash against our educational institutions, mm-hmm. against elite institutions like the one where I work, where I've yes. worked for a really long time. And I think we all need to be thinking about that, mm-hmm. about where that comes from. And about what that implies in terms of how we practice education, in terms of how we do our writing and research, mm. in terms of who we do it for, and ultimately in terms of the range of possible relationships one could imagine between our educational institutions on the one hand and these wider processes of social change on the other. The reality is that so much of what we do in the name of our intellectual lives, in the name of generating and propagating knowledge, can be highly alienating. Mm-hmm. It can be alienating on account of the language we use. It can be alienating on account of the perspectives that we validate and the perspectives that we dismiss very quickly. Hmm. It can be alienating simply because of how inaccessible these institutions are, hmm. physically, economically, geographically, in terms of where we publish, in terms of who we publish for, hmm. in terms of who we're willing to communicate with and who we're not so interested in communicating with. All of these things, I think, are patterns that we can also think critically about. Those of us who are in higher education, what would it mean to democratize access to the ideas that we take seriously in the academy? What would it mean to democratize the language we use in the academy? What would it mean to democratize our research processes, such that we work more in a collaborative mode, in a way that brings people on board as co-participants in a process of inquiry, rather than treating them as objects
yeah.
of studies that benefit those of us on the inside primarily. These are all things, I think, that a lot of academics have been thinking about, have been wrestling with, have been experimenting with in terms of doing things differently. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a lot more work of that kind to do.
Yeah.
And I think that would actually go a long way in terms of dealing with some of those suspicions that you're talking about. Certainly when I was doing this research, if I went around the country lecturing people about how I felt they ought to think or about why I felt that I was right and they were wrong.
Yeah.
I could not have gotten very far in terms of the conversations that I wound up having. And so, you know, it took a different spirit, the spirit of willingness to listen, to hear out other people's perspectives with patience and even acceptance, at least acceptance of those perspectives as their perspectives, even when I disagreed deeply with what people were saying, which is naturally and inevitably going to be the case because all of us are different. And the positions we hold in a society have a great deal to do with the commitments we have.
Now, where do you think the current fear stems from? I know, like, obviously the pandemic in 2020 really created that, this, like, self, you know, this fear of others and social anxiety for a while. But I guess the overarching fear of change, where does that stem from? Is it post 9/11, starting 2001, or is it deep? Has it been deeply rooted throughout the nation's history? As you talk about regarding like you mentioned, I believe, was it like 1800s? The yellow fever down in Georgia.
Right.
Does it start back then? Where does the fear of others come in, I guess? Sorry, touched the bone.
I think the fear of others comes in whenever you have a social and political environment created that, on the one hand, brings others into the mix as necessary constituents of that society and that economy, but then on the other hand, denies them their humanity, denies them their value, denies them the right to participate as equals in that society. You have a fear of others whenever others are included as secondhand members of that society, because that fear is intimately bound up with the fundamental of that social formation, because people won't be satisfied with being treated as second-class members or non-members of that society. People aren't simply going to tolerate being exploited and having their labor extracted and their value and their humanity denied. Another way to put this is that fear of otherness has everything to do with the deep history of racism and social inequality that has been with this country as long as it's existed. And we continue to see it manifest in different ways. And so on the one hand, it is certainly the case that contemporary developments like 9/11 or the pandemic, contemporary moments when you see something happen unexpectedly, when people are shaken by the sense of a certain kind of vulnerability or exposure that they didn't know they had, right? It changes things. It changes the texture of things. It changes the feeling of things. It changes the way that people relate to each other. But a lot of what I'm trying to show in the book is that the way in which people respond to those moments, the way in which people engage those moments, has a great deal to do with our inheritance of those earlier histories, our inheritance of those earlier moments. That history remains with us. Those inequalities remain with us. And until we acknowledge that and take seriously the work of repair, of reparation, of a deeper acknowledgement of the fundamental inequalities that have structured social experience in this country for literally centuries, you're going to see, on the one hand, people expressing a great deal of concern and upset about the persistence of those inequalities, and you're going to see other people trying to, you know, sort of write that kind of perspective out of the picture, because it's not something that they want to take seriously. So there is a deeper reckoning, I think, that we do need. It seemed that we were maybe headed in that direction a few years ago. I'm not sure that's where we're headed now, but I think it's important to keep that perspective alive, to keep that deeper historical perspective and a wider sense of the kind of social nature, of the kind of social change that is necessary in a country like ours to bring a long overdue and absolutely necessary justice back into focus.
I agree. There's also, though, like, how do we solve the great wealth divide? And just a note in general in human society, though, in general, in the history of human society, any hierarchy in power structure of human society has always been, there's always been the people who have left behind and the disadvantaged throughout history, of course, and our history is sapiens. So any system, there's always, seems like there's always going to be the left behind, you know, and always a power structure. Are there persons that have more than most? But we tend to find our nation today at an extreme divide, wealth divide right now.
Yeah.
How do we deal with that?
Yeah. So the first thing I would say is that genuine solutions are really hard to come by.
Oh yeah, no.
I mean, like it's really
hypothetically, it's really, academically, yes.
It's really hard to figure out how to do anything meaningful with regard to some of these deep abiding problems. And so I would say that my task with a book like this is less about, has less to do with solving the problems than with trying to give as robust an account as I can give about why they're as serious and intractable as they are. And then maybe point to some openings.
Yeah.
Look, here are these folks that are trying this thing. Here are these folks that are trying that thing. If we ran with that a little bit, where might we get?
Yeah.
Right? So it is more conjectural. I don't think it's, I mean, there are other folks maybe, you know, who feel comfortable solving problems at that scale, but it's not really something that I feel qualified to do. So I want to just say that to begin with. Another thing I want to say, though, is that power works in different ways. There are many different ways in which power works. And I think that one of the basic ways in which power works, especially in a society like ours, is by propagating the idea that things are the way they are because it's natural, because it's normal, because it's human nature, because things are, this is how things always are. This is how people always are. There are all these narratives that we find ourselves faced with when we deal with circumstances of the kind that you're describing, conditions of radical, inexcusable economic inequality, wealth inequality, right? Like there are things people will say, well, how can we accept this? How can we abide by this? And there are going to be voices that say, well, no, it is natural. It is normal. This is human history. This is human nature. This is just how it's going to be. There have always been haves and have-nots. And I think actually one of the more interesting lessons of recent scholarship in fields like mine is that some of the assumptions we make around the necessary and natural foundations of social inequality have more to do with the assumptions we bring to bear in our research than they do with the actual range of human history. You actually have plenty of interesting examples of societies that are far more egalitarian than ours, and in fact, far more deeply and actively committed to creating and protecting the circumstances that nurture equality, that make possible a more egalitarian way of living in the company of others. So there is evidence of that kind as well.
Yeah.
In the human record, in the historical record, in the archaeological and anthropological record. So then it becomes a question of, you know, what kind of society we want and what will it take to work there, to get there. But the difficulty is, just to kind of come back to this question of how markets, and in particular how capitalism works in our country, there is so much money to be made in propagating fear, in propagating isolation, in propagating suspicion. There's so much money to be made by kindling and exacerbating these conditions of radical isolation and mutual suspicion, that we find ourselves at the mercy of the companies that do this, the algorithms that do this, the media empires that are trafficking in these ideas. And so ultimately, so much turns on the extent to which we can continue to build out and support alternative ways of sharing ideas, sharing experiences, building connections and coalitions that create counterweights to the way in which money and power are organized and come to work so often in a society like ours.
So it really comes down to grassroots efforts in the communities again. Say, go out to rural Georgia and say, this is how you, first of all, also get proper communication channels and ability to access information, proper information, and make decisions based off of the diverse range of information. But also, how do you combat what's true and false in this day and age of, you know, information manipulation, one would say. And there needs to be deep education on that, of how to recognize what is a false and misleading article that could lead you one down a rabbit hole and a skewed perspective of what's really going on. So how do you combat that?
Yeah, I think
larger,
the metaphor,
that's a larger question, of course. But
I think the metaphor of the rabbit hole, because it is ultimately a metaphor, is actually a pretty interesting one. Right, it's not about rabbits as such. It's about that hole. It's about that sense of being bunkered, right? It's about that sense of being siloed. It's about that sense of being walled off in a space where you don't see anyone else, you don't hear or encounter anything else. You're off on your own. Yeah. And so on the one hand, you could fret a great deal about what's going on in the minds of those who've fallen into those silos, what they're thinking, right? What kinds of disturbing thoughts or ideas or whatever they might begin to have. But I think there's a value to actually thinking a little more about those situations of isolation to begin with.
Yes.
Because if you open up that, I don't know, pit in the ground a bit, let the daylight in, then it no longer works the same way. So what does that mean in practice? What circumstances can we create such that people are in more regular contact with people unlike them, with perspectives unlike the ones they have, with experiences unlike the ones they take for granted, with stories of other people in other places that might unsettle some of the assumptions they make. One of the most interesting and surprising and rewarding dimensions of doing this work over the course of many years for me was meeting people again and again who did not fit the stereotypes I had, say, for example, of what it meant to be a conservative in this country, or a Republican in this country, or a libertarian. When I began to have more meaningful encounters with people on the other side of the political spectrum, I was continually surprised, not only by the range of commitments that people made, but also by the sense of trouble that so many people I met had themselves about where we were headed, where we're going, in the sense that we might in fact be at a breaking point unless we learn how to do some of this work again together. So that tells me that there remain reasons to be hopeful, regardless of how polarized and deadlocked things might appear. But everything turns on whether or not we can create the circumstances for more meaningful encounters with the real difference of people's lives, rather than always, in a sense, just sort of being confronted by one phantom or another, and just imagining what those other people and those other ideas might be and might imply about what is ultimately a country and a planet that we're all forced to share.
I think I had a few ideas on that, on how to do so, where there's cross-cultural programs where, say, in like whatever grade, we're all forced to, say, live rural America if you're in the urban setting, or people in rural America live in the urban setting for a while, just like study abroad as supposed to do. How about if we have programs like that where we just interchange our counties and, you know, just an idea. I just spitballing.
It's fascinating.
It's cross-cultural within our own nation as well.
It's fascinating. And one of the things that really, you know, intrigues me about an idea like that is that it tracks so closely with what we do as anthropologists, with what we do as researchers in a field like anthropology, immersing ourselves in other cultures and societies, spending time with people whose everyday lives are really different from our own, but also, honestly, what we do in the classroom as teachers, where we're inviting students to really sit with stories from other places, of people and their travails from other times and places, and to try to imagine that human experience all over again from those other standpoints. So I really appreciate the logic of what you're saying, and the idea of a kind of structured service program that would put people in other places is intriguing for that reason, but I don't know that it has to be that dynamic. Sorry, that dogmatic. I don't know that it has to be forced in that way. I think that creating circumstances in which people are able to take in stories of fundamentally different ways of being in the world, imagining themselves in, say, from the standpoint of those that they may not think that they have very much in common with, and yet find that they might, find that they can relate. All of those things, I think, can be helpful. And I would say that some of the more hopeful moments in this book in particular have to do with moments of that kind, where you had people organizing for a certain kind of social change, say for racial justice or gender justice, building coalitions, trying to find ways of building up support for one kind of effort or another, and doing it by inviting people to imagine themselves in the circumstance of someone radically different from them, and sometimes doing it quite successfully. I think that there's a great deal of value in that. I think that there's a lot of ways in which an endeavor like that could be practiced, right? I think, frankly, even radio shows like yours, where you're bringing people on and inviting them to talk about their work and what it's like to do this work from their own individual standpoint. You say, let's begin, tell me your story. And you begin that way, I feel like you're already doing it. I feel like we have those spaces. We have those spaces in our culture. We need to protect those spaces. We need to fund those spaces. Yes, yes. We need to ensure their continued viability.
And that stems through a vibrant community to upkeep spaces like such, WGXC, and just independent spaces where people to get together. And that's where I found myself just in harmony with, like, artist spaces. And in the artist world, there's tight-knit communities of creators in all, particularly up here in Hudson, there is in the Catskill region. There's lots of groups of makers. And I which I've never would have imagined myself experiencing in kind of living in this type of region. I've always thought of myself more living in the city, but I've become quite engaged in such communities in Hudson, as I found it more community-oriented than just living in New York City.
That's a wonderful thing to hear. And I do think a lot about commons in the book. I think about the importance of having common spaces, of spaces where people can gather and come together and form community in the way that you're talking about. And that's part of what I'm thinking with, again, on that more positive and affirmative side in the book. But getting back to the question that you asked earlier and bringing it back around to what's happening through a community radio station like the one that we're speaking through, commons aren't just physical. They can also be digital. They can also be media-based. What would it mean to invest further in media commons, to ensure that our media aren't completely and utterly and totally dominated by a handful of corporations and their specific profiteering interests, but instead open to the kind of community building that you're talking about? What would it mean to have spaces that are ultimately about safeguarding and promoting the interests of those communities, rather than using community as a vehicle by means of which, a corporate bottom line is better served? Like, this is also something that's really important and something I think that we need to take seriously, and we need to protect. We need to protect our physical gathering spaces, but also our virtual, digital, and media gathering spaces.
I agree. Yeah. We have only a few minutes left. One question regarding the book. How do you plan to kind of break the wall and get your book out to, one would say, the other side? I feel like the book, I would pick up the book if I noticed in stores and maybe like-minded individuals, but how do you have is there a way, do you think, people on different points of view will pick up this book?
You know, I think that I think we do what we can.
Yeah.
And we hope that whenever we do what we can, we do it in a way that doesn't presume that we're talking to one kind of person and not to another.
Yes.
Throughout this conversation, I've really tried, I don't know if I've done it successfully, but I've tried to speak and think in a way that doesn't make assumptions about who might be out there, about who might be listening.
Yeah.
I've gotten all kinds of response from this book. A lot of people have written to me. They've written to me having read the book. They've written to me having read different excerpts that have appeared in various media, interviews, and so on. And some of them have definitely come from people who disagree really deeply with me, or on the contrary, come from a different political position, but find something interesting and meaningful enough in what I've written that they find it worthwhile reaching out. I think we can all do that better, actually. I think we can learn how to express ourselves in a way that might speak honestly and truthfully about where we come from, and what we take seriously, and what we're committed to as individuals. But on the other hand, to do that in a way that doesn't necessarily disparage those who have other points of view, doesn't rest on a condemnation of where other people come from, doesn't force people to pick sides.
And not to cut you off, we have about 20 seconds. Where can people find you on the digital realm and pick up the book? We get 20 seconds.
All right. Google my name. You'll find me in all kinds of ways. My name is Anand Pandian. I have a personal website. It's called Anand.